Chapter 7. Dawn broke, and once again Jack was knocked up. Once again he was torn from the arms of an ideal Mrs. Wogan with the news of a ship fine on the larboard bow. This time the Leopard's topgallants had already vanished, but it was little more than a gesture to the conventions of war, because this time the Vaxham Height was a good 3 miles nearer, perfectly recognisable in spite of the mist hanging over the cold, milky sea, hanging and parting in the light air from the east, so that sometimes she almost entirely vanished, and sometimes she looked spectral, unnaturally large, as she bore up, spread her wings, and headed for the Leopard. They were already at the edge of the westerly current, and the breeze chopped up the pale surface. But there was nothing of a sea, nothing resembling the great rollers with the hills and dales that so favoured a heavier ship. And by noon the Leopard, setting all she could carry and steering south-west, had run the Vaxham Height out of sight. "May we cry your triumph?" asked Stephen at dinner. "It's 2 hours since she vanished, wallowing in impotent rage." "I'm not going to cry EO anything at all until we pick up our moorings in Simon's Bay," cried Jack. "With Turnbull and Hollis here, I didn't like to say anything at breakfast, but I don't know that I've ever seen anything so shocking in all my life as that Dutchman at dawn, sitting there to the windward between us and the Cape. It was exactly as though he'd been leaning over my shoulder last night while I worked out my course. And I'm by no means easy in my mind about this morning's performance, neither. It was too far off to be certain with the haze, but I had an ugly feeling he wasn't chasing wholehearted. No skysails, as I dare say you remarked. Maybe his pole-to-gallant masts won't bear him, but it seemed to me he wasn't so much eager to catch us as to drive us south, away to the leeward. In his place, and with his advantage in men, I should try to carry the ship by boarding, rather than batter her into matchwood and maybe have her sink on me. What a triumph to carry a sound 50-gun ship with him to the Indies! And he may be waiting for his opportunity. However, I shall do all I can to cross his wake tonight, and if only I can get the weather gauge with the wind anywhere east of south, I shall try a luffing match with him. We can lie closer to the wind, and those broad-bottomed ships always sag to leeward more than we do. So in any sea where Leopard can stay, I believe we could leave him a great way astern by beating up. Leave him for good and all. And I hope to be windward of him tomorrow." A vain hope. Jack's plan of crossing the Dutchman's wake in the night was frustrated by a dead calm. And in the afternoon of the next day, while all hands were bending a fresh suit of heavy weather sails, the Vaxham Height was seen in the nor'east, bringing up the breeze. She was a noble sight, with stunsails aloft and alow, gleaming under the clouded sky, towering canvas that gleamed with a more than ordinary and, as it were, inward glow. For she, too, had shifted her suit in preparation for the winds to be expected farther south. But the Leopards couldn't admire her. They'd all seen the spent ball that damaged the figurehead, and they all knew that behind the lower deck ports of the approaching Vaxham Height lay a long tier of Dutch 32-pounders, throwing metal nearly half as heavy again as their own guns. The best part of the Leopard's hull was heart of oak, so was the best part of her crew. But there wasn't a man aboard who concealed his delight when the breeze reached the Leopard too, filled her stout new canvas, and caused the water to gurgle under her counter as she gathered way. A little later, the capricious air began to fail the Vaxham Height. She put down her helm and opened a distant cannonade that effectually killed what little wind there was. Slow, deliberate fire. gun by gun from her upper tier. Single shot with a heavy charge of powder. Almost always short. But remarkably good practice. And some of the ricochets came aboard. He couldn't hope to accomplish a great deal at this distance. His 12-pound upper deck shot couldn't do half as much harm after the first graze as the Dutchman's 24-pounders. But there was always the chance of carrying away a spar or cutting up the rigging, which would be all to the good with the Vaxham height 5,000 or 6,000 miles from the nearest source of supply. And then a stray shot might hit a cartridge box or a lantern between decks, starting a fire and even blowing up the magazine. That was long, long odds, but he had known it happen. Yet there were other, far more important considerations. Since her captain delighted in gunnery, and since he was well-to-do, the Leopard was exceptionally rich in powder and shot. And if Jack, by provoking the Vaxham height, could induce her to fire shot for shot, sending most of it into the sea, he would be relatively the gainer. Then he knew very well that even the most intrepid heroes didn't much relish sitting mute waiting to be fired at, and many of the Leopard's landsmen were not heroic at all. Furthermore, experience had taught him that no target on earth could excite such a zeal, such careful, deliberate aiming, as one's fellow men. This was a perfect opportunity for getting the best into his gun crews. The Leopard made the fullest use of it, and occasionally the fall of her shot would send water over the Dutchman's side, while twice, to rapturous cheers, the well-served number 7 gun struck home, whereas the Vaxham height did nothing but send one spent ball into the Leopard's hammock netting. Yet Jack had a growing disagreeable conviction that his colleague over the water had exactly the same thing in mind, that he too was profiting from the situation to work up his crew, his horribly numerous crew, to an even higher state of perfection. Jack could see him clearly through his telescope, a tall man in a light blue coat with brass buttons, sometimes standing on his quarterdeck smoking a short pipe at intervals of scrutinising the Leopard, sometimes walking about among the upper deck guns. And in spite of the cheering and pleasant spirit aboard, Jack was heartily pleased when another light air, neglecting the Vaxham height, enabled him to run out of range. That night, the night of the new moon, they lay with very little movement until the morning watch, when cold rain came sweeping from the west, and a moderate swell made the Leopard pitch as she stood for the distant cape, now considerably to the north as well as east. No one had to wake the captain this time. He was on the quarterdeck well before sunrise, muffled in a pilot jacket by the lee rail. As he'd expected, the first light showed him the Vaxham height, far over between him and Africa, steering a course that would cut his own in a few hours' time. Jack brought the wind upon his starboard beam. The Dutchman did the same, but no more. He didn't attempt to close. And so they ran all day through the rain, running parallel courses south and south. Now and then a squall would hide one from the other, but every time it cleared, there was the Vaxham height, keeping station as faithfully as if she were the Leopard's consort, attending to her signals. Sometimes one would gain a mile or two, sometimes the other. But by nightfall they were at much the same distance apart, having run off 130 miles by dead reckoning. No sight of the sun at noon with all that driving cloud. After dark, Jack began beating up, tack upon tack, both watches on deck, hoping to shake off the Vaxham height, which was not such a windward ship, and then to fetch a wide cast northwards to cross her wake far out of sight. And so he might have done, had not the wind failed him, leaving the Leopard with little more than steerage way drifting westward on the current, so that once again the morning sun showed her that odiously familiar shape, exact to the rendezvous. It was that night, after a day of manoeuvring in light airs that boxed the compass, that the Vauxhallite made her attempt at boarding. The sun set clear in a sky that promised a true breeze in the morning. There was a fair amount of starlight before the young moon rose, and it showed the Dutchman ghosting nearer under skysails, although there wasn't a ripple on the long oily swell. The movement was scarcely perceptible at first, and only the successive disappearance of the lowest stars betrayed it to the lookout's watchful eye. The 74 must have picked up the first whisper of the air as it was born, and when it brought her within gunshot, she heaved to and opened up with a most spectacular series of rippling broadsides. The Leopard was already at action stations. The battle lanterns gleamed behind her open larboard ports. Both tiers of guns peered out. The smell of burning match drifted along the decks. But until the ships were closer, Jack wouldn't give the order to fire. He stood on the poop, staring across the water with his night glass. He didn't wholly believe in this attack, and he was searching for the boats he would himself have launched. No sign. No sign at all. But then, when he'd almost given up, he caught the flash of oars, very much farther from the ship than he'd reckoned on. The Dutch captain had launched them on his blind side in the dark, and had sent them off crammed with men at least half an hour ago. They were pulling fast in a wide arc to take the Leopard on the starboard side, while the Vauxhallite engaged her with distant gunfire on the other. "The fox!" said Jack, and he gave orders for boarding netting, for the guns to be drawn and reloaded with grape, and for all the marines to leave the guns for their muskets. The attempt failed, because a slant of wind wafted the Leopard southward faster than the boats could pull, so that she caught the leaders, cutting them up most dreadfully with grape shot at 200 yards. And because the Vauxhallite lost too much time picking up the surviving boats and men to take advantage of the breeze. But it might very well have succeeded. Jack's ship couldn't fight both sides at once, and the men in the boats outnumbered his crew. "I shall not run that risk again," he said. "Whatever wind we have, I shall beat up, even if it means going directly away from the Cape for days on end. By every sign and by all the rules, it should come from the south, and so much the better. With luck," he said, touching the wooden handle of his sextant, "a southerly breeze should let us work up well into the 40s, where we can be sure of no calms. He has to have a calm night for that kind of frolic." True to the rules, for once, the morning's wind backed right round into the south. It was neither a steady nor a convincing breeze, but several mollymawks and one great albatross were seen, sure signs of stronger winds not far away, and it did allow the Leopard to work well ahead, tacking like clockwork every other glass, and staying perfectly each time. The 74 did her best, whipping her heavy yards round like wands, but she couldn't lie so close. On every leg she lost several hundred yards, and once she was obliged to wear, which cost her the best part of a mile. A long, anxious day, with the surest helmsman at the wheel, the leeward guns run in, the windward out to make her stiffer still, every possible device to wring a little extra thrust from the breeze, and the clumsier hands nearly murdered by their mates for the slightest blunder. But a day that left the Vauxhallite hull down in the north, so that after the drum had beat the retreat, Jack ordered hammocks to be piped down in order to allow the exhausted larboard watch some sleep. "Luff and touch her," was the order of the night, as the Leopard held steady on the starboard tack with the westerly current, now much stronger, to ease her way. In the morning, the Vauxhallite was no more than a pale wink against the dark clouds on the horizon. She'd reduced sail, and she seemed discouraged. More albatrosses appeared during the forenoon watch, and a more normal life began again. The wardroom was no longer part of a naked gun deck. Its cabins were set up once more, and the usual quite civilized dining room had reappeared, decorations and all. The meal itself, glutinous soup, sea pie and duff, was no Lord Mayor's banquet, but it was hot. And Stephen, chilled through and through from watching albatrosses in the main top, ate it eagerly. Between courses he gnawed a biscuit, tapping the weevils out in what was by now an automatic gesture, and he contemplated his messmates. In the article of clothes, the sailors were not a very creditable lot, being dressed in a disagreeable mixture of uniform and old warm garments, sometimes wool and sometimes cloth. Babington wore a knitted Guernsey frock inherited from Macpherson that hung in folds upon his little form. Byron had on two waistcoats, one black, the other brown. Turnbull had come out in a tweed shooting coat. And although Grant and Larkin were somewhat more presentable, on the whole they made a sad contrast to the neat marines. Stephen had contemplated them from time to time since the beginning of this tension, and sometimes their reactions had surprised him. Benton, the purser, for instance, never showed the least anxiety about being taken, sunk, burnt, or destroyed. But the leopard's vast consumption of candles in the battle lanterns and elsewhere rendered him gloomy, silent, irresponsive. Grant, too, was rather silent, and had been ever since the first shots were fired with intent to kill. Silent, that is to say, when Stephen or Babington were present. When they were not, as Stephen gathered from the chaplain's remarks, he spoke at length about the measures he would have adopted had he been in command. The leopard should either have attacked at once, relying on the effect of surprise, or have sailed north directly. Fisher was altogether of his mind, though he admitted that his opinion was of no great value. There was a growing sympathy between the two men, some underlying similarity. In other respects, the chaplain was quite changed. He no longer visited Mrs. Wogan, and he even asked Dr. Matchelin to carry her the books she'd been promised. "Ever since my near escape from death in battle," he said, "I've been thinking very seriously." "To what battle do you refer?" asked Stephen. "To the first. A cannonball struck within inches of my head. Ever since then I've reflected upon the old adage about never allowing fire near inflammable material, and about the dangers of concupiscence." He was obviously willing to be questioned and to open his secret mind, but Stephen didn't wish to hear. Since the jail fever he'd lost interest in Mr. Fisher, who seemed to him a commonplace man, too much concerned with himself and his own salvation, one whose attraction faded on acquaintance. He only bowed and accepted the books. He had the impression that both Grant and Fisher were in a state of powerful fear. There were no evident direct signs of it, but both complained very often. A stream of blame and disapproval of the modern state of mind, the present generation, their useless idle servants, the ill conduct of the government, of the political parties, and of those about the king. A general denigration, a frequent imputation of motives, always discreditable. They reminded him of his maternal grandmother in her last years, when, from being a strong, sensible, courageous woman, she grew weak and querulous, her expression of general discontent increasing with her vulnerability. He didn't know how either of them would behave in a really bloody fight, whether their manliness would reassert itself in an obvious crisis. As for the others, he had little doubt. Babington he'd known since the lieutenant was a boy, as brave as a terrier, and Byron was of the same familiar naval genus. Turnbull would probably do well enough for all his loud-mouthed hectoring. Moore had seen a great deal of service. He would shoot and be shot at with great good humour as a matter of course. It was his profession. And Howard, the other lobster, would surely follow, in his phlegmatic military way. As far as Stephen could make out, there was almost no connection between the flute-playing Howard and the stuffed marine lieutenant. He did have reservations about Larkin, however. The master's courage and professional ability might be very well, but by now he was fairly pickled in alcohol. And unless Stephen's judgment were much at fault, his body was very near the limit of its resistance. They drank the King. Stephen pushed back his chair, not choosing to stay with the execrable wine, tripped over Babington's Newfoundland for the 100th time, and stepped onto the quarter-deck for another glance at his albatross, a noble bird that had been sailing along with the ship since breakfast. Herapath was there, talking to the midshipman of the watch, and they gave him news of the Vaxumheit, out of sight these 2 hours past, even from the jacks. "Long may she stay so," said Stephen, and returned to work in his cabin. This cabin, being on the orlop, didn't disappear when the ship cleared for action. And at intervals, even during these trying days, he'd carried on with the task begun shortly after Herapath had confided in him. It consisted of drawing up a statement in French, describing the British intelligence network in France and some other parts of Western Europe, together with passing references to the United States and allusions to a separate document dealing with the situation in the Dutch East Indies. With its details of double agents, bribes offered and accepted, and treason in the ministries themselves, it was designed to cause disruption in Paris if there were, in fact, a connection between Mrs. Wogan's chiefs and the French. And it was intended to be conveyed to those chiefs by Mrs. Wogan herself, by means of Herapath. This statement was to have been found among the papers of a dead officer bound for the East Indies. The officer wasn't named, though, of course, Martin, who had spent half his life in France and whose mother tongue was French, was clearly indicated. Copies of the document were to be made for the authorities, and Dr. Maturin, knowing that Herapath was fluent in that language, was to ask him to be so good as to help with the work. Stephen was certain that the artless young man would tell his Louisa, and that Mrs. Wogan would soon get transcripts out of him, whatever honourable resistance he might put up at first. That she would then laboriously encode them, poor dear, and oblige Herapath to send them from the Cape. Stephen had poisoned many sources of intelligence in his time, but if all went well, this promised to be the prettiest piece of intoxication ever that he'd brought about. Such a wealth of material at his disposition, such utterly convincing details known only to himself, to Sir Joseph, and to a few men in Paris. "What now?" he said angrily. "Come quick, sir," cried a ghastly marine. "Mr. Larkin's murdered our lieutenant." Stephen caught up his bag, locked his door, and ran to the wardroom. 3 officers had pinned Larkin down, and they were tying his arms and legs. A bloody half-pike on the table. Howard lay back in his chair, his mouth and eyes wide open in his white, astonished face. Larkin was still jerking and writhing with convulsive force and delirium tremens, making a hoarse animal roaring. They overcame his violence and carried him away. Stephen probed the wound, found the aorta severed at the crest of the arch, and observed that death had been almost instantaneous. The master had got up from the table, they told him, just as Howard began to screw his flute together, had taken a half-pike from the bulkhead, had said, "There's for you, you flute-playing bugger," lunging straight across between Moore and Benton, and had then fallen roaring on the deck. "You're strangely quiet," said Mrs. Wogan, as they walked upon the gangway an hour or two later. "I've made at least two witty observations, and you've not replied. Surely, Dr. Maturins, you should wrap up a little more in this damp and horrid cold."
"I'm sorry, child, to seem so low," he said. "But a little while ago, one of the officers killed another in a drunken fit. The sweetest flute I ever heard. Sometimes I feel that this is indeed an unlucky ship. Many of the men say there is a Jonah aboard."
Some days later, for the Marines insisted upon a proper coffin and a plate for the lieutenant, they buried Howard in 41 degrees 15 minutes south, 15 degrees 17 minutes east, the Leopard heaving to the strong west wind for the purpose. Once again the logbook recorded, "Committed the body of John Condom Howard to the deep." And once again Jack wrote, "Discharged, dead," against his name. After a melancholy, sober dinner, at which Stephen was the only guest, Jack said, "Tomorrow I think we may head north. With common luck, we should raise the Table Mountain in 3 or 4 days, and then we can get rid of that poor raving maniac." They had been south of 40 degrees since Thursday, and although at this season, the beginning of the austral summer, even the westerlies were not quite to be relied on north of 45 or even 46, they had proved true enough for the Leopard. And together with the current, they'd carried her over 200 nautical miles between one noon observation and the next, day after day, with never a glimpse of the Vaxumheit. "Do you know, I wonder whether the Americans have a consul at the Cape?" asked Stephen. His document was done. Herapath was copying it. The train was laid. "I wouldn't swear to it, but most probably they have. Any number of their Far Eastern ships touch there, to say nothing of sealers and the like. Why do you..." He choked his question short and said, "What do you say to a turn on deck? The heat of that stove's killing me." On deck, Stephen pointed out one particular albatross among the half-dozen following the ship. "That dark fowl is, I conceive, a nondescript species, and not exulans at all. See his cuneate tail? How I should love to visit his breeding grounds. There, you may see his tail again." Jack gazed politely and said, "Upon my word." But Stephen saw that the creature's tail was of no very great consequence to him, and said, "So you think we've shaken off the Dutchman? What a persistent fellow he was, to be sure. And devilish sly, too. I believe he was in league with the devil, unless..." He had been about to say, "unless we have a witch aboard that communicates with him by a familiar spirit, as many of the hands believe. They say it is your gypsy." But he disliked being called superstitious, and in any case he didn't really give much credit to the tale, so he continued, "That's to say, unless he could read my thoughts and have private notice of the winds into the bargain. Still, this time I like to think we've lurched him good and hearty. By my reckoning, he should only go north somewhere about 75 or 80 east for the southwest monsoon. Indeed, I should be quite confident of it, but for one thing.
What thing is that, Tell? Why, the fact that he knows where we're bound and that we did claw his boats most cruelly.
I beg your pardon, sir, said Grant, walking across the deck, but they send to tell the doctor that Larkin's at it again.
They need scarcely have sent. The howling welled up from the master's cabin where he lay bound, filling the quarter-deck in spite of the strong voice of the wind.
I shall be with them directly, said Stephen.
Jack paced on with a melancholy shake of his head. 10 minutes later, the lookout hailed, Sail ho! On deck there! Sail ho!
Where away?
Called Jack, all thoughts of Larkin gone.
Broad on the larboard beam, sir. Topsails on the rise.
Jack nodded to Babington, who raced up to the masthead with a glass. Some moments later, his voice came down, spreading relief throughout the attentive, silent ship.
On deck, sir. A whaler. Steering south and east.
The wardroom steward, pinned to the half-deck by the first awful hail, continued his course. And passing the marine sentry outside the master's cabin, he said, It's not the Dutchman, mate, only a whaler, God be praised. On the other side of the door, Stephen said to Herapath,
There. That should calm him. Pray, put up the tundish and come along. We'll have a dish of tea in my cabin. We have certainly deserved a dish of tea.
Herapath came along, but he wouldn't linger, nor would he drink his tea. He had a great deal of work to do, he said, avoiding Stephen's eye, and must beg to be excused. Poor Michael Herapath, wrote Stephen in his book. He suffers much. I know the harrow's mark too well ever to mistake it, the harrow directed by a determined woman. Perhaps I shall give him a little of my laudanum to tide him over to the Cape. Since her hands were protected from impressment, the whaler was not unwilling to be spoken by a British man of war. She was the Three Brothers from London River for the Great South Sea, she said, in answer to the Leopard's, what ship is that? Last from the Cape. No, she hadn't seen a single sail since she cleared False Bay. Come aboard and crack a bottle, called Jack over the wind and the grey, heaving water. The whaler's words were balm to him. They did away with the lingering, almost superstitious doubt that had kept his eye perpetually turning to the windward for that white fleck on the horizon that, in spite of all his calculations, would prove to be the devilish Vaxumheit. It was notorious that whalers had the sharpest eyes of any men afloat. Their livelihood depended on seeing the distant spout, often in a torn, tormented, cloud-covered waste of sea, and they always had men up there in their crow's nests watching with the most constant eagerness. The remotest gleam of topsails couldn't escape them by day, nor yet by these late moonlit nights. The master of the Three Brothers came and cracked his bottle and talked about the pursuit of the whale in these largely unknown waters. He knew them as well as most men, having made 3 voyages, and he gave Jack some particularly valuable information about South Georgia, correcting his chart of the anchorages in that remote, inhospitable island, in case the Leopard should ever find herself in 54 degrees south, 37 degrees west, and about the few other specks of land in that vast, far southern ocean. But presently, as the full bottles came in and the empty were carried away, his accounts became wilder. He spoke of the great continent that must lie round the pole, of the gold that was certainly there, and of how he should ballast his ship with the ore. Sailors rarely feel that they've done their duty if their guests leave them sober, but Jack was perfectly satisfied as he saw the whaler plunge into his boat. He bade the three brothers farewell and a happy return, and worked out his course for the Cape. The Leopard brought the wind a little abaft the larboard beam in a fine, fierce curve, white water sweeping over her waist, and began to run northwards under courses and reef topsails, her deck sloping like a moderately pitched roof, and her lee chains bedded in the foam that came racing from her bows. She was heading for dirty weather, for a low bank of cloud with rain squalls drifting across its face and hidden lightning within the mass. It was precious cold, and spray whipping across the deck in the eddy of the mainsail kept wetting the captain's face. But he was warm within. Not only had he a comfortable coat of blubber as well as his pilot jacket, but he also had a glow of satisfaction. He continued his pacing, counting the number of turns on the fingers clasped behind his back. 1,000 he would take before he went below. At each turn he glanced up at the sky and out over the sea. A mottled sky, blue and white to the south, with a steely gleam on the farthest rim, grey, high-piled storm breeders in the west, darkness north and east. And, of course, a mottled sea, though in quite different tones, running from middle blue through every shade of glaucous grey to black, and the whole streaked with a white that owed nothing to the sky, but all to the broken water and the spindrift of former storms. The long, even, fairly heavy swell lifted him and set him down at a measured pace, so that sometimes his horizon was no more than 3 miles away, and sometimes he saw an enormous disk of ocean, a cold, uneasy sea, endless miles of desolation, the comfortless element in which he was at home. The surface of his mind was concerned with that unhappy man, the master. His books had proved to be hopelessly confused, neglected these many weeks. One of Larkin's duties was to keep tally of the Leopard's water, but from the scrawled, haphazard notes, Jack couldn't make out the present state. He and the mate of the hold would have to creep about in the depths, thumping casks and starting bungs. He wouldn't ask Grant to do it, now that the First Lieutenant had to keep a watch. A cantankerous, unwilling dog, with no desire to please, no good will, careful never to commit himself by a hasty word, but always ready with some objection, with general blame and discontent. A miserable sod. A good seaman, though, that must always be admitted. He thought of Breadfruit Bligh and his nasty reputation. "Before you judge a commander," he said on his 700th turn, "you must know just what he had to command." Jack himself had had to speak to Grant in terms that might have earned him the name of a rough-tongued Turk. He hadn't lost his temper, but in the matter of Grant's interference with his orders about the storm trysail, he'd spoken very plain. He turned aft, 751. He heard exclamations, saw faces staring, pointing hands. "Sir! Sir!" cried Turnbull, Hollis and the quartermaster all at once, and from the masthead, "Sail ho!" with extreme urgency. "On deck! On deck there!" He whipped round, and there, in the west-nor-west, directly to windward, emerging from a black squall with lurid light behind, he saw the Vauxhallite. No hanging threat on the far horizon, but hull up not 3 miles away. "Port your helm," he said. "In driver, out reefs. Fore to gallantsail." The Leopard turned round on her heel so fast that Babington's dog was flung outwards, colliding with a carronade. Hands raced for the brails, braces, sheets and tacks, and the ship steadied on her course right before the wind. The Vauxhallite and the Leopard had seen one another at much the same moment, and aboard both ships the sails came flashing out as quickly as the hands could move. The Vauxhallite carried away a main topgallant the minute it was sheeted home, and the cloth streamed forward, fouling her stays. "He's in earnest this time," thought Jack. "We must crack on." But the leopard's masts wouldn't stand another stitch of canvas without going by the board. He felt the backstays and shook his head, gazed up at the tall-to-gallant masts and shook it again. No question of striking them down on deck at this juncture. "Pass the word for the bosun," he said. The bosun came running aft. "Mr. Lane, get warps and light hawsers to the mastheads." The bosun, a dark fellow in a perpetual ill temper, opened his mouth. But the look on the captain's face turned his remark to an "aye, aye, sir," and he plunged below, piping for his mates as he went. "Let's try the main t'gallantsail, Mr. Babington," said Jack, when the ship had taken the full thrust of the wind right aft and all her way was on her. The upper yardsman lay aloft, ran out on the yard, let fall. The yard rose, the mast complained, the backstays grew tauter still, but the good canvas held, and the leopard's speed increased perceptibly. Jack looked aft over the tearing wake. The 74 was a little farther off. "So far, so good," he said to himself. And to Babington, "Clue up, however. We'll try again when the bosun's done his work." So far, so good. The leopard was just gaining, just outrunning the Vauxhallite with the canvas she could bear at present. She could certainly hold her own and better in this wind and in this sea. But he didn't want to go any further south, where the westerlies blew harder still. After an hour, he altered course due east. Instantly, the Vauxhallite steered to head him off, running the cord of the leopard's arc, gaining more than Jack liked to see, and at the same time setting a curious little triangular sail like an inverted skyscraper from the yardarms of her main t'gallant to the cap. "This is no time to jig," reflected Jack. The Vauxhallite had the master hand as far as course was concerned, and he put the leopard before the wind once more, a west-nor-west wind with a distinct tendency to haul norther still. Then, raising his voice to the foremast head where Lane was toiling with his crew, clinging to what frail support there was, their pigtails streaming forward stiff and straight, he called, "Mr. Lane, should you like your hammock sent aloft?" If the bosun made any reply, it was drowned by the striking of 8 bells in the afternoon watch, followed by all the ritual gestures. The log was heaved, as clear of the huge wake as it would go, the reel whirled, the quartermaster bawled out, "Nip!" The midshipman reported, "Just on the 12, sir, if you please." The officer of the watch chalked it up on the logboard. The carpenter made his report, 3 inches in the well, sir." And Jack said, "Ah, Mr. Gray, I was just about to pass the word for you. Deadlights in the cabin, if you please. I don't want to get my stockings wet if a following sea should get up tonight." "Deadlights it is, sir, for nothing are so unwholesome as wet stockings." Gray was an old, old man, a master of his trade, that he might be a little chatty. "Would it cut up rough, sir, do you reckon?" By most standards it had cut up rough long ago. The leopard was pitching like a froward horse, white water over her bows. And although the wind was right aft, where in moderate weather it had been almost mute, they now conversed in a strong shout, while spray whipped off the rollers, shot past them to vanish forward. But they were in the 40s. And in the 40s, this wasn't worth speaking of. Not what would be called real weather at all. "I doubt it may. Look at the gleam to leeward, Mr. Gray." The carpenter looked and pursed his lips, glanced aft to catch the Dutchman on the rise, and pursed them again, muttering, "What can you expect when we got a witch aboard? Deadlights this minute, sir. And hawse bags, of course." So they ran another glass, and at the striking of the bell Jack moved to the poop. There, crouching with his telescope behind the taffrail, he inspected the Vauxhallite. The moment he had it focused on her forecastle, he had a curious shock, for there, full in his glass, was the Dutch captain looking straight at him. There was no doubt about his tall, burly form, the distinctive carriage of his head. Jack was familiar with the enemy. But now, instead of his usual light blue, he had a black coat on. "I wonder," thought Jack, "whether it's just an odd chance or whether he killed some relative of his. His boy, perhaps, dear God forbid." The 74 was gaining slightly now, and in the strong remaining light, for the evening was much longer down here, and the two ships had run well clear of the gloom of the north, Jack could make out the nature of those odd triangles. There was another at the fore-to-gallant now, and it was a storm staysail, suspended by its tack.
"If you please, sir," said a midshipman, young Hillier, "the boatswain says all is stretched along, and might he have a party?"
A tidy party it'd have to be, for Jack's plan was to supplement the backstays with hawsers, no less, so that the immensely strengthened masts might bear a great press of sail with a following wind, the strain being transferred to the hull. But to bowse the massive cordage so taut that it would serve its office called for a most uncommon force. Once, when he was third of the Theseus, they'd set the mainsail in a hurry to claw off the Penmarks, and a southwester blew so hard that 200 men were needed to haul the sheet right aft. He didn't have 200 valid men. But he did have a little more time than the captain of the Theseus with the breakers under his lee. None to waste, however, with the 74 only 3 miles away and running off the mile in just 5 minutes, and above all, no time to make a mistake. The mast lost in this sea was sure destruction. "A Burton tackle to the Chestry," he called, loud and clear. "Lead aft to a snatch block fast to the aftermost ring bolts and forward free. Look alive there, look alive! Light along that snatch block, Craig!" Order came from apparent confusion in 5 minutes. The half-drowned bosun's party scrambled in from the Chestries, and the whole ship's company crowded into the waist and along the gangways, standing by the cablets that were to act as horizontal falls, working with a threefold power. "Silence fore and aft," cried Jack. "Starboard, tally on. At the word now, and all together cheerily, like a bowline. Ho one, ho two, ho belay, larboard clap on. Ho one, ho two, ho belay." So it went, on either side. Short, sharp pulls, aft from the Chestries, forward from the snatch blocks, and the hawsers tightened evenly, tighter and tighter yet. A most careful balancing of forces, until the wind sung the same note in each, and each pair was iron-taut, supporting its mast with extraordinary strength. "Belay!" cried Jack for the last time. "Well, fare ye, lads. Are you ready, Mr. Lane?"
"Ready, aye, ready, sir."
"Cast off all. Main to gallantsail there." The yard rose up. The mast took the strain without a groan. The Leopard's bow wave grew higher still with her increasing speed. Now the spritsail topsail followed, while to ease her plunging they hauled up the mainsail, giving all the wind to her forecourse. She sailed easier yet, with no slackening in her pace, clearly outrunning the Dutchman, although he'd shaken out his foretopsail reef. They raced furiously over the empty, heaving sea under a clear late evening sky, both ships driven very hard. And the first to lose an important spar or sail would lose the race that night. The sun was setting. In an hour and 40 minutes the moon would rise, a little past her full. With the afterglow and then the strong moonlight, there'd be small chance of jigging unperceived. Yet, half an hour before the moon, he would bring the wind a point or so on the quarter, just so that the jibs and forward staysails would stand, and give him another half knot or even more. And all things being considered, hammocks might be piped down. The larboard watch would turn in with all their clothes on in case of emergency, and there was no point in keeping them at quarters shivering behind their tight-closed ports. The crisis, if it came to that, was some way off. Perhaps a great way to the east. He'd chased 48 hours before this. In the darkened cabin, he found Stephen with his cello between his knees and a soup tureen at his side.
Judas, he said, lifting the lid and beholding emptiness.
Not at all, my dear. More is on the brew, but I cannot recommend it. Should be better with a glass of water, tempered with a few drops of wine. A very few drops of wine, and a piece of biscuit.
What did you eat it for, then? Why didn't you leave a scrap, not a single scrap?
'Twas only that I felt my need was greater than thine, my business of greater importance than your business. For whereas yours is concerned with death, mine is the bringing forth of life. Mrs. Boswell is in labour, and some time tonight or tomorrow I think I may promise you an addition to your crew. 10 to 1, another fucking woman, said Jack. Killick! Killick there!
More soup appeared. Chops, hot and hot. A jug of coffee and a wedge of solid duff.
Will this last long, do you suppose? Asked Stephen over the booming of his cello.
A stern chase is a long chase, said Jack.
And would you consider this a really stern one?
It couldn't well be more so. The Dutchman is in our wake. He is dead astern.
So that is the significance of the term. I'd always supposed it to mean an eager, a grim, a most determined pursuit inspired by inveterate animosity. Well, and so this is a stern chase. Listen, did I tell you something for my part? A breach presentation is a long, long labour too. It looks to me that the both of us have an active night ahead. You will allow me to call for another pot. Stevens was active enough, with no proper forceps and no great experience of midwifery. But after Jack had gone on deck to alter course, southwards, since the Dutchman expected him to go north, and had stared at his pursuer for a while by the light of the risen moon, he stretched out on his cot and went straight to sleep. The outer jib and the foremast staysail were standing well. The Leopard was steering easy, and the 74 was between 4 and 5 miles astern. She hadn't perceived Jack's smooth change of direction for some time, and she'd not set her own headsails until the Leopard was close on another mile ahead. He woke refreshed. Yet his sleeping mind had recorded the crash of water against the deadlights, and coming on deck, he wasn't surprised to find that both wind and sea had increased. The cold, brilliant moon showed an even array of tall waves sweeping eastward, wide apart, with a deep trough between. And now their heads were curling over, streaming down the leeward side in a white cascade. And the general note of the wind in the rigging had risen half an octave. If this grew worse, and from the look of the western sky, the feel of the air, it must grow worse, he would have to put the Leopard before the wind again. The ship couldn't stand a heavier sea upon her quarter without being thrown off her course. The Vauxhall Height was still at much the same distance, but that wasn't likely to last. The graveyard watch wore on bell by bell, and still they ran, starting neither sheet nor tack, an eager, grim, and most determined pursuit. At 8 bells, with both watches on deck, he took in the spritsail, got the yard fore and aft, set the inner jib, and bore up another point. It might be his last chance of doing so, for the air was now filled with flying water, and the ship was tearing through the sea at a rate he never would have believed possible, a rate that in fact would have been impossible without those hawsers to the mastheads. But this was no longer the exhilarating pace of a few hours ago. Now there was a nightmare breakneck quality about it. And now the wind was blowing very hard indeed. Half an hour towards the morning watch, and hour after hour the wind increased. Twice, just after seven bells, the Leopard was very nearly pooped by a freakish bursting sea. The steady progression of the rollers was losing its regularity, becoming disordered. Eight bells again. Then he put the ship before the wind, taking in the staysails. It was impossible to get an accurate reading of the log, for the blast tossed the logboat forward of her bows. And now the carpenter's mate reported 2 foot of water in the well. The Leopard had been working and straining so much that a good deal had come in through her sides, let alone that which made its way down from the decks in spite of the laid hatches, and through the hawse holes in spite of the bags. The sun rose on a sea in labour, the crests riding ahead of the swell and breaking, creaming water from horizon to horizon except in the bottom of the troughs, much deeper now, while from every height the wind tore foam, drops and solid water, driving it forward in a grey veil that darkened and filled the air. The Vaxham Height lay within 2 miles. And now the extreme danger of sailing in a very heavy swell became more and more apparent. In the troughs, the valleys between the waves, the Leopard was almost becalmed, while on the crest the full force of the wind struck her, threatening to tear her sails from their boat ropes or to carry away her masts. Even worse, she lost some of her way at the bottom, whereas she needed all her speed to outrun the following seas, for if they were to overtake her, she'd be pooped, smothered in a mass of breaking water. Then, 10 to 1, she'd slew round and broach to, presenting her broadside to the wind, so that the next sea would overwhelm her. This was by no means the worst sea Jack had known. It was still far from the total chaos of a 10 days' blow, enormous waves with a fetch of 1,000 miles running into one another, rising mountain high, breaking, tumbling and bursting with enormous force. But it looked as though it might build up into something of the same kind. And already the Vaxham Height was showing how much the larger ship was favoured. Her higher masts, her greater mass, meant that she lost less way when partially becalmed, and she was now not much more than a mile away. Yet, on the other hand, she had either taken in or lost her odd triangles. An albatross glided down the starboard side, turned on the wind and shot across the wake, picking something from the surface as it flew. And it was only when he saw the brilliant flash of its wings that he realised how yellow the foam was, in fact. Even at this time of great concentration on his ship and the countless forces acting upon her, he was astonished at the bird's perfect control, at the way its gleaming 12-foot wings lifted it without the least effort and sent it flanking across the oncoming sea in an easy, unhurried curve. "I wish Stephen could," he was thinking, as the Leopard climbed the crest ahead. But a crack followed and the sound of threshing canvas cut him short. The foretopsail had split. "Clew up! Clew up!" he cried. There was a chance of saving it. "Halyards there! Maintopsail!" He ran forward, calling for the boatswain. No boatswain, but Cullen, the captain of the foretop, was at the mast, and the boatswain's mates. They secured the topsail, the yard lowered on the cap, while the ship plunged down the long slope among the smother of the breaking crest. The close-reefed maintopsail kept the Leopard ahead of the following seas after no more than a few minutes' hesitation. But it was too far aft for the ideal thrust. Her speed wasn't so great, and she might steer wild. It was still possible to bend another foretopsail. "Pass the word for the boatswain," he shouted. and at last the man came stumbling aft. Drunk? Not dead drunk, but incapable. "Get along, forward," said Jack to him, and to his older mate, "Our cloak carry-on. Number 2 foretopsail and the best robins in the store." A cruel struggle out there on the yard. Cruel and long. Fighting with canvas animated by such a force. But they bent the sail at last and came down, hands bleeding. The men looking as though they'd been flogged. "Go below," said Jack. "Get your hands bound up. Tell purser steward I say you're to have a tot apiece and something warm." Leaning over the rail, his eyes half shut against the driving spray, he saw that the Vauxham Height was now within 1,000 yards. He shrugged. No ship, no first rate, not even a Spanish four-decker, could show her broadside in such a sea. "Mr. Grant," he said, "let the pumps be rigged. We're steering rather heavy." Then, with a look at the new foretopsail, tight as a drum, he went below for a bite himself. Like the Dutch captain, Killick seemed able to read his thoughts. Coffee and a pile of ham sandwiches were carrying in as Jack hung his streaming sou'wester on its peg and walked into the gloomy cabin, where he sat on a locker by the starboard gun. Not a gleam came from the stern windows, their glass replaced by solid wood, and even the skylight had a tarpaulin over it. "Thank you, Killick," he said after a first ravenous gulp. "Any news of the doctor?" "No, Your Honour. Only Howells and Mr. Hennepath took poorly. It must be worse before it can get better, that's what I always say." "No doubt, no doubt," said Jack uneasily, and he applied himself to the sandwiches. Thick, cold pancake instead of bread, but welcome. Slowly champing, he mused on women, their hard lot, on the curse of Eve, on Sophie, on his daughters growing fast. An immense crash of splintering wood, a surge of flying spray, a flood of light, and a spent cannonball broke in upon his thought. He peered out through the broken deadlights and saw another flash in the Vauxham Hyde's bows. No sound in this universal roar, and the smoke was swept instantly away. But it was clear that the 74 had opened up with her chasers, trained sharp followed from the bridal ports in her bluff bows, and that a lucky shot had struck right home, smashing his coffee cup. A chance in a million. "Killick! Another cup!" he called, carrying the rest of his breakfast into the dining cabin. "And let Chips come aft." "I'd never expected that today," he said to himself. Certainly the aim of warfare was the destruction of the enemy, and he'd seen French ships totally destroyed in fleet engagements. But in single-ship actions, the idea of capture usually predominated. He'd expected the 74 to hunt him down and take him, or try to take him, when the weather moderated. In this sea, there was no possibility of capture, and the Dutch captain's intent could only be to kill. Any engagement must mean the total loss of the first ship to lose a mast or a vital sail, and thus the control of her run, the death of every soul aboard her. "A bloody-minded man, I see." He didn't spend long below, but how things had changed when he next came on deck. It was not that the wind was greater. Indeed, there was a slight but certain lessening, but that the sea had grown steeper still. And the ship was labouring now, heavy on the rise, although the chain pumps were shooting a great gush of water over her side. The storm jib would have to come in. It was pressing her down. And in any case, the boom was whipping like a bow. "Mr. Grant, we'll get in the storm jib and goosewing the main course." "Surely, sir," began the older man. He looked much older now, but went no further. With the thrust lower, the leopard fairly wallowed in the deeper troughs. Yet her speed was still so great that she could certainly avoid the following seas with skilful handling. Jack named a team of men to take the wheel, prime seamen, four at a time, two glasses to a trick. The danger was more the shock when the wind took her full on the crests. And ordinarily Jack would have had her under a close reef foretopsail alone or even less, just enough to keep her ahead. But with the Vaxamheit creeping up, he dared not take more in, nor could he haul up the jib again. If this went on, he'd have to compensate the lack of thrust by lightening the load. He would have to pump out the tons and tons of fresh water down there in the hold. The Vaxamheit was half a mile away. He saw two flashes, but never the pitch of the shot, quite lost in this white turmoil. He made a tour of the ship. Long, wind-hurried strides followed, a battle against it aft, which showed him that all was as snug as could be in such a case, and that there was no likelihood of any change of sail for some while, no voluntary change. And he called for Moore, Burton, and the best gun captains in the ship. "Sir," said Grant, as he was leaving the quarter-deck, "the Vaxamheit's opened fire." "So I gather, Mr. Grant," said Jack, laughing, "but two can play at that game, you know." He was surprised to see no answering smile at all. But this wasn't the moment for brooding over his lieutenant's moods, and he led his party into the cabin. They cast loose the guns, removed the wing deadlights, and looked out onto a soaring green cliff of water 50 yards away, with the Leopard's wake trace down its side. It shut out the sky, and it was racing towards them. The Leopard's stern rose, rose. The enormous wave passed smoothly under her counter, and there, through the flying spume, lay the Vaxamheit below, running down the far slope. "When you please, Mr. Burton," said Jack to the gunner. "A hole in her foretopsail might make it split." The larboard gun roared out, and instantly the cabin was filled with smoke. No hole. No fall of shot, either. Jack to starboard had the Dutchman in his dispart sight. A trifle of elevation, and he pulled the lanyard. Nothing happened. Flying spray had soaked the lock. "Match!" he cried. But by the time he had the glowing end in his hand, the Vaxamheit was below his line of sight, below the depression of his gun. From down there in the trough she fired up, a distant wink of flame, and she got in another couple of shots before the grey-green hill of water parted them again. "May I suggest a cigar, sir?" said Moore. "One can hold it in one's mouth." He was acting as sponger and second captain, and his face was 6 inches from Jack's. He was encased in oilskins, and there was nothing of the marine about him but his fine red face and the neat stock showing under his chin. "A capital idea," said Jack, and in the calm of the trough, before the Vaxamheit appeared again, Moore lit him a cigar from the glowing match in its tub. The Leopard began to rise. The Dutchman appeared, black in the white water of the breaking crests high up there, and both 9-pounders went off together. The guns leapt back, the crews worked furiously, grunting, no words, sponged, loaded, and ran them out again. Another shot, and this time Jack saw his ball, dark in the haze of lit water, flying at its mark. He couldn't follow it home, but the line was true, a little low. Now they were on the crest, and the cabin was filled with wind and water mingled, unbreathable. The gun crews worked without the slightest pause, soaked through and through. Down, down the slope amidst the white wreckage of the wave, the guns run out and waiting. Across the hollow and up the other side. "I believe I caught his splash," said Moore, 20 yards short of our starboard quarter. So did I, said Burton. He wants to knock our rudder, range along and give us a broadside, the bloody-minded dog. The Varksome Height over the crest again. Jack poured the priming into the touch-hole with his horn, guarding it with the flat of his hand, the cigar clenched between his teeth and the glow kept bright. And this bout, each gun fired three times before the Leopard mounted too high, racing up and up, pursued by the Dutchman's shot. On and on. An enormous switchback, itself in slow, majestic motion, but traversed at a racing speed in which the least stumble meant a fall. Alternate bursts of fire, aimed and discharged with such an intensity of purpose that the men didn't even see the storm of flying water that burst in upon them at each crest. On and on, the Varksome Height gaining visibly. Here was Babington at his side, waiting for a pause. "Take over, Moore," said Jack as the gun ran in. He stepped over the train tackle, and Babington said, "She's hit our mizzen tops, her fair and square." Jack nodded. She was coming far too close. Point-blank range now, and the wind to help her balls. "Start the water all but a ton, and try the jib 1/3 in." Back to the gun as it ran out. Now it was the Varksome Height's turn to fire, and fire she did, striking the Leopard's stern post high up, a shrewd knock that jarred the ship as she was on the height of the wave. And a moment later a green sea swept through the deadlights. "Good practice in this sea, Mr. Burton," said Jack. The gunner turned his streaming face, and its fixed, fierce glare broke into a smile. "Pretty fair, sir, pretty fair. But if I didn't get home 2 shots ago, my name's Zebedee." The Flying Leopard drew a little way ahead with the thrust of her jib, 100 yards or so, and the switchback continued the distances the same. It was the strangest gunnery, with its furious activity and then the pause waiting to be fired at, the soaking at the crest, the deck awash, the intervening wall of water, the repetition of the whole sequence. No orders, none of the rigid fire discipline of the gun deck, loud, gun-deafened conversation between the bouts. The dread of being pooped by the great seas right there in front of their noses, rising to blot out the sun with unfailing regularity, and of broaching to, hardly affected the cabin. A savage roar from Burton's crew. "We hit her port lid," cried Bondon, the second captain. "They can't get it closed." "Then we're all in the same boat," said Moore. "Now the Dutchman'll have a wet jacket every time she digs in her bows, and I wish they may like it." A short-lived triumph. A midshipman came to report the jib carried clean away. Babington had all in hand, was trying to set a storm staysail. Half the water was pumped out. But although the Leopard was lighter, she felt the loss of the jib. The Varksome Height was coming up. And now the vast hill of sea separated them only for seconds. If the Leopard didn't gain when all her water was gone, the upper deck guns would have to follow it. Anything to draw ahead and preserve the ship. The firing was more and more continuous. The guns grew hot, kicking clear on the recoil, and first Burton and then Jack reduced the charge. Nearer and nearer, so that they were both on the same slope, no trough between them. A hole in the Dutchman's foretopsail, but it wouldn't split. And 3 shots in quick succession struck the Leopard's hull close to her rudder. Jack had smoked 5 cigars to the butt, and his mouth was scorched and dry. He was staring along the barrel of his gun, waiting for the second when the Varksome Height's bowsprit should rise above his sight, when he saw her starboard chaser fire. A split second later, he stabbed his cigar down on the priming, and there was an enormous crash, far louder than the roar of the gun. How much later he looked up, he couldn't tell. Nor, when he did look up, could he quite tell what was afoot. He was lying by the cabin bulkhead with Killick holding his head and Stephen sewing busily. He could feel the passage of the needle and of the thread, but no pain. He stared right and left.
"Hold still," said Stephen.
He felt the red-hot stabbing now, and everything fell into place. The gun hadn't burst. There was more fighting it. He'd been dragged clear. Hit. A splinter, no doubt. Stephen and Killick crouched over him as a green sea gushed in. Then Stephen cut the thread, whipped a wet cloth round his ears, one eye and forehead, and said, "Do you hear me now?" He nodded. Stephen moved on to another man lying on the deck. Jack stood up, fell, and crawled over to the guns. Killick tried to hold him, but Jack thrust him back, clapped onto the tackle, and helped run out the loaded starboard gun. Moore bent over it, cigar in hand, and from behind him Jack could see the Vaxamhide 20 yards away, huge, black-hulled, throwing the water wide. As Moore's hand came down, Jack automatically stepped aside, but he was still stupid. He moved slow, and the recoiling gun flung him to the deck again. On hands and knees, he felt for the train tackle in the smoke, found it as the darkness cleared, and tallied on. But for a moment he couldn't understand the cheering that filled the cabin, deafening his ears. Then, through the shattered deadlights, he saw the Dutchman's foremast lurch. Lurch again, the stays part, the mast and sail carry away right over the bows. The Leopard reached the crest. Green water blinded him. It cleared, and through the bloody haze running from his cloth, he saw the vast breaking wave with the Vaxamhite broadside on its curl, on her beam ends, broach to. An enormous momentary turmoil of black hull and white water, flying spars, rigging that streamed wild for a second, and then nothing at all but the great hill of green-grey with foam racing upon it. My God! Oh, my God, he said. 600 men.